I'm John Aran, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity. I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Explaining football to the friend who's just there for the nachos? Hard. Tailgating from home like a pro with snacks and drinks everyone will love? An easy win. And with Instacart helping deliver the snack time MVPs to your door, you're ready for the game in as fast as 30 minutes. So you never miss a play or lose your seat on the couch or have to go head-to-head for the last chicken wing. Shop game day faves on Instacart and enjoy $0 delivery fees on your first three grocery orders. Offer valid for a limited time. Other fees and terms apply.
Had some showers around yesterday, typical summertime. Sunday, the first official day of fall, the autumnal equinox, which doesn't really mean a lot for us here. But anyway, we'll celebrate accordingly, I guess. Justin Buechler joins us now, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. 47 days, 18 hours, 45 minutes until the presidential election. I don't know if that's till the end of voting or whatever, but you figure 47 days. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. What about polls? How much can we glean from polls at this moment?
Well, we're getting to the point where the polls mean a significant amount, keeping in mind that at this point, we shouldn't be paying attention to the national polls. We should be paying attention to the state-by-state polls because it's an electoral college system. The other thing to keep in mind is don't pay attention to any one individual polls. We need to pay attention to the polling averages because any one poll can just be an aberration. But if you take all of the polls together, you start to put together a reasonable picture of how any one state is looking. So look at the polls altogether as an average and focus on the state by state at this point.
I am mathematically challenged, Professor. So let me ask you this. When I look at a poll and it says Trump's ahead by one, Harris is ahead by one, but the margin of error is plus or minus three. Does that mean anything? I understand the margin of error, what it means, but I'm saying, does that really indicate that anybody's leading?
So it means that the candidate listed as having an edge is more likely than not to win, but you don't have a whole lot of confidence in it. Mm-hmm. So if you see Harris ahead by one with a margin of error of plus or minus three, or Trump is ahead by one with a margin of error plus or minus three, then if you have to bet, which you really don't, then you bet on whoever has a lead. Then that's how you bet. But don't put a lot of confidence in those numbers. That's basically what it means, because you're looking essentially at a statistical tie. But the thing to notice is that when all of the swing states are going in one direction, that tends to suggest that that candidate has a lead, because it's not entirely a state-by-state phenomenon. What tends to happen is that you have a set of factors that operate nationwide. So if all of the swing states are moving together, then you get a picture of what's moving all of the swing states.
So what is the situation with the swing states?
So what's happening with the swing states is they tend to be moving a little bit more consistently in the Democratic direction, basically because in a year like 2024, what's happening is that you have a Democratic president in the White House, but the Democrats have only held one term, and it tends to be two, then two. That's the general pattern. And the economy is actually sort of chugging along. I mean, if you look at Q2 GDP, the latest revisions were at about 3% for Q2 GDP. The economy is chugging along. We're about to get a rate cut from the Fed. And what that means is you have a reasonably good economy. The Democrats have won one but not two terms. That tends to favor the incumbent party. So that's the Democrats. And that means that things are moving a little bit towards the Democratic Party, not a lot. So we don't have a whole lot of confidence in this. And the polls are moving a little bit in favor of the Democrats, but it's still a close race.
Is there anything that we can glean from the non-swing states, any polls that show any movements that would indicate an undercurrent for either candidate?
Well, we don't really have a lot of polls on the non-swing states because it costs money to do polls, and the people who are conducting the polls aren't focusing on the non-swing states because there's not a whole lot to be done from it. So we have the national polls, and the national polls show Harris ahead by a small amount, not enough to be really big advantage, but nobody does extensive polling on California or Texas because we know that California will vote for a Democrat no matter who the Democrat is. We know that Texas will vote for the Republican no matter who the Republican is. So there's really nothing to be gained by presidential polling in the non-swing states. We have the national polling, and the national polling, you can sort of track that on a pretty consistent basis, and the national polling has been shifting a little bit more to the Democrats, as one might expect when the economy is doing reasonably well. But we don't really do a lot of polling on states that we can already predict, regardless of what the circumstances are, because we're not really looking at elections like the occasional blowout that we used to have long ago, decades ago, like 1964, 1984, where everybody knew in 1964 that Johnson was going to win. 1984, you had that blowout election of Reagan versus Mondale. We don't get those anymore. The country's just too close for that.
Is there any undercurrent of either something that would take precedent in terms of voters' minds that anybody's picking up on, whether it's the economy, whether it's abortion, whether it's something else that is going to determine the race?
The economy is the thing that's always there. Every election, the economy is there. The thing about an issue like abortion is that it's factored into everybody's party identification. Most voters are partisans. Party ID is the biggest determinant of vote choice. But what's already happened is that pro-choice voters are Democrats, pro-life voters are Republicans. So everybody's opinions on abortion that's already been factored into their party identification. So whatever voters think about abortion is already built into their vote choice through party identification. And that's true for a lot of issues. On the other hand, the economy fluctuates from year to year, from election to election, and it's always a critical determinant of independent voters' vote choices. So that's the thing that we study as the thing that can move. I'm sort of stumbling over my word here, but that is what shifts, and it's not built into party identification as a stable factor. Everything else is either built into party ID or it's just going to cancel out.
Well, let me take a break because I saw an article in the New York Times today. It is, I think, about AI, QAnon, and falsehoods reshaping the presidential race, and we know what's going on with Ohio and the pets and this and that and the other thing. So we'll talk about all that when we come back. Also, the second attempt at an assassination on former President Trump, does that play in any of this? Are there any, I guess, wild cards when it comes to the presidential race? We're talking with Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. You may know who you're going to vote for, and I'm sure a lot of people do, but I'm trying to see if there's any undercurrent there of people that might say one thing and then do another when they go to the polls, or possibly what's going to happen in those swing states, and how many voters are we talking about? 150,000 people that are going to swing this election. 622 traffic now, WWL.
Explaining football to the friend who's just there for the nachos? Hard. Tailgating from home like a pro with snacks and drinks everyone will love? An easy win. And with Instacart helping deliver the snack time MVPs to your door, you're ready for the game in as fast as 30 minutes. So you never miss a play or lose your seat on the couch or have to go head-to-head for the last chicken wing. Shop game day faves on Instacart and enjoy $0 delivery fees on your first three grocery orders. Offer valid for a limited time. Other fees and terms apply.
I'm John Oran, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity. I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
627, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We continue to count down to the presidential election with Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. All of the presidential elections are historic. All of them will change the country forever. How important is this one, Professor, given the level of, I guess, pardon me, division in the country? Your thoughts on that as a political scientist?
We always say it's the most important election, or somebody always says that. Some of the elections were less important. So 1996, when they said it was the most important election, the best they could come up with was that whoever won would be president when it became the 21st century, which was not a very good argument. Mm-hmm. This is probably pretty important when you look at the ideological division between the candidates and the parties. The division between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, the division between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party right now is quite big. And that means that there are dramatic policy implications to who wins. It's hard to say that this is the most important election when you consider, let's say, 1860. Just as a point of reference.
Yeah, that was pretty important.
Anyone who wants to say this is the most important election in history needs to remember times like 1860. But considering how far apart Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are on policy, this is certainly more important than, for example, 1996, when we sort of had the post-Cold War era of relative peace and prosperity.
I'm always looking for an edge, something flying beneath the radar. You see any wild cards out there, Professor, something that maybe the pundits are missing?
If I knew it, I would be placing bets in the stock market about it.
Mm. That's interesting, too, about the economy, because, you know, inflation's bad, stock market's doing great. I'm still trying to get an answer on whether the economy's good or bad, and it depends on, I guess, who you talk to, just like everything else. Is it working for you? Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time, as always. Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. Let me ask you at 504-260-1870, how's the economy working for you? Inflation's eating me up, but I eat the same stuff all the time, so it doesn't really matter, I guess. I don't buy that many groceries to begin with, but the 401k is through the roof. So tell me, is the economy working for you or not? What grade would you give the economy as it works for you? We'll talk with Ramon Antonio Vargas when we come back about the Archdiocese and a settlement with abuse victims. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. 16 till 7. Ramon Antonio Vargas joins us now, our friend, editor and reporter at The Guardian. How you doing, Ramon?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for taking the time. And, you know, I always appreciate you and David Hammer and the work that you all do as it relates to this. So many different stories that would not see the light of day were it not for your work, and this is a particularly ugly one as it comes to the Archdiocese of New Orleans and abuse survivors. Give me a little bit of context and the latest on what your reporting says, if you can, Ramon, please.
Sure. We reported last week that obviously the bankruptcy, the Archdiocese at one point was faced with so many clergy abuse lawsuits related to the, clergy abuse, clergy molestation scandal that's been going on there for decades, that it filed for bankruptcy. And this was all the way back in 2020, after years of legal wrangling, $40 million in expenses. Finally, on Friday, both a committee that represents clergy molestation victims and their interest in the bankruptcy, as well as the Archdiocese, went ahead and filed their plans to settle. And they had kind of imposed a deadline of Monday, like self-imposed that deadline to do it. And they went ahead and filed it. They went ahead and filed, competing plans to kind of settle the entire thing. And it is safe to say they are quite a bit apart. And the best way to kind of put it to you is that the Victims Committee is seeking about $2 million per claim to settle, and the church's competing offer is about $125,000 per claim. And that's obviously once you start kind of counting how many claims you're talking about, the distances become quite a bit. You got in bigger numbers. Another way to put it, it's the victims are asking for about, $1 billion. But I mean, the bulk of that, more than $800 million of that would be from insurance companies. It'd be about $84 million from the archdiocese that they're seeking, and then the affiliates would be about $133 million, if I remember correctly. And that's going to be, keep in mind that it's about more than 180 apostolates, right? So you're talking about schools, individual churches, ministries like Christopher Holmes, et cetera. So that they'd be divided that among, more than, if it works out. So they're looking for about a little less than $1 million from each of those. And then the archdiocese's counteroffer is $62.5 million, divided among the archdiocese and its apostolates, its affiliates. Nothing from insurance. I've been trying to get some clarity on that. I'm curious as to. I know certainly the archdiocese has been given the opinion that they don't believe that the insurance companies don't believe that they're on the hook for any of the abuse claims.
Never believe that they're on the hook for anything, right?
Sure. And then and this is the most important thing, right? The reason, I think one of the big reasons between the gulf that exists between those two figures, right, is the abuse survivors and their advocates scored a major legal victory when the Supreme Court upheld a law, the state Supreme Court, Louisiana Supreme Court upheld a law that gave people in Louisiana the right temporarily to sue for abuse claims and to pursue civil damages over, molestation claims long ago. And it didn't matter how long ago it was, it's statute of limitations, prescription, et cetera. None of that was a factor. The only organization, and it wasn't exclusively, targeting, the Catholic Church or anything like that. The only organization to oppose the law when it was being passed was the Louisiana Catholic Conference, the Louisiana Conference Catholic Bishops. They certainly, Catholic organizations, filed briefs supporting, opposing the law's constitutionality. I think it was the Diocese of Lafayette that requested that law be struck down as unconstitutional. Victims kind of like triumph in that fight, and I know that that law was upheld, and so that's what they believe that their values. They argue, and I think they have a lot of evidence for it. I mean, given that now they have the constitutional right to do it, that it would cost more. I think the church continues, and they've reflected this position openly in court, that they continue to believe that law, no matter what the state Supreme Court has said, that law is unconstitutional. Those claims are prescribed, or those claims have been filed too late, and so they are basically worthless, the bulk of them.
Let me take a break here, Ramon, if I can. When we come back, one question I have is, I'm looking at your story here. A vast majority of the money in the abuse claimant's proposal, roughly $800 million, should come from the insurance companies, according to the plan. But the church counteroffers with $62.5 million, more than $900 million less than what they were looking for, that $800 million from insurance companies and then $84 million from the archdiocese and its affiliates. I guess what I'm wondering is, who's negotiating for whom? Is the archdiocese trying to protect their assets or protect the insurance company? Because if I'm the archdiocese, I'm saying, well, if I want to do what's right by everybody, well, then let's turn this over to the insurance company. And why isn't the insurance company involved in this? Maybe you can clear all of that up when we come back. 651 traffic now, WWL. 6:56, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back with Ramon Antonio Vargas, editor and reporter at The Guardian. He's got a story about what the church is offering. Victims are seeking $1 billion. Church is offering $62.5 million. I don't know who's lowballing whom here. If we just hear that commercial, is the insurance company lowballing the victims? Is the church lowballing the victims? Why did they not turn this over to the insurance company? I'm confused, Ramon.
Yeah, I've been seeking some clarity in that myself. I mean, I know earlier in the proceeding, right, insurance companies have certainly spoken up about feeling sort of like not feeling kind of like shut out as far as like the mediation process, as far as like, you know, this process of working towards a settlement, which obviously has been years long.
Let me ask you at 504-260-1870, how's the economy working for you? Inflation's eating me up, but I eat the same stuff all the time, so it doesn't really matter, I guess. I don't buy that many groceries to begin with, but the 401k is through the roof. So tell me, is the economy working for you or not? What grade would you give the economy as it works for you? We'll talk with Ramon Antonio Vargas when we come back about the Archdiocese and a settlement with abuse victims. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. 16 till 7. Ramon Antonio Vargas joins us now, our friend, editor and reporter at The Guardian. How you doing, Ramon?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for taking the time. And you know, I always appreciate you and David Hammer and the work that you all do as it relates to this. So many different stories that would not see the light of day were it not for your work, and this is a particularly ugly one as it comes to the Archdiocese of New Orleans and abuse survivors. Give me a little bit of context and the latest on what your reporting says, if you can, Ramon, please.
Sure. You know, we reported last week that obviously the bankruptcy, the Archdiocese at one point was faced with so many clergy abuse lawsuits related to the, you know, clergy abuse, clergy molestation scandal that's been going on there for decades, that it filed for bankruptcy. And this was all the way back in 2020, after years of legal wrangling, $40 million in expenses. Finally, on Friday, both a committee that represents clergy molestation victims and their interest in the bankruptcy, as well as the Archdiocese, went ahead and filed their plans to settle. And they had kind of imposed a deadline of Monday, like self-imposed that deadline to do it. And they went ahead and filed it. They went ahead and filed, you know, competing plans to kind of settle the entire thing. And it is safe to say they are quite a bit apart. And the best way to kind of put it to you is that the victims committee is seeking about $2 million per claim to settle, and the church's competing offer is about $125,000 per claim, and that's obviously once you start kind of counting how many claims you're talking about, the distances become quite a bit. You got in bigger numbers, another way to put it, it's the victims are asking for about, you know, they're asking for, you know, $1 billion, but I mean the bulk of that, more than $800 million of that would be from insurance companies. It'd be about $84 million from the Archdiocese that they're seeking, and then the I think the affiliates would be about $133 million, if I remember correctly, and that's going to be, keep in mind that it's about more than 180 apostolates, right? So you're talking about schools, individual churches, ministries like Christopher Holmes, et cetera. So that they'd be divided that among, you know, more than, if it works out, so they're looking for about a little less than $1 million from each of those. And then the Archdiocese's counteroffer is $62.5 million, divided among the archdiocese, and it's apostolates, it's affiliates, nothing from insurance. I've been trying to get some clarity on that. I'm curious as to, I know certainly the archdiocese has been given the opinion that they don't believe that the insurance companies don't believe that they're on the hook for any of the abuse claims.
Insurance companies never believe that they're on the hook for anything, right?
Sure. And then and this is the most important thing, right? The reason, I think one of the big reasons between the gulf that exists between those two figures, right, is the abuse survivors and their advocates scored a major legal victory when the Supreme Court upheld a law, the state Supreme Court, Louisiana Supreme Court upheld a law that gave people in Louisiana the right temporarily to sue for abuse claims and to pursue civil damages over, molestation claims long ago. And it didn't matter how long ago it was, it's statute of limitations, prescription, et cetera. None of that was a factor. The only organization, and it wasn't exclusively, targeting, the Catholic Church or anything like that. The only organization to oppose the law when it was being passed was the Louisiana Catholic Conference, the Louisiana Conference Catholic Bishops. They certainly, Catholic organizations, filed briefs supporting, opposing the law's constitutionality. I think it was the Diocese of Lafayette that requested that law be struck down as unconstitutional. Victims kind of like triumph in that fight, and I know that that law was upheld, and so that's what they believe that their values. They argue, and I think they have a lot of a lot of evidence for it. Given that now they have the constitutional right to do it, that it would cost more. I think the church continues, and they've reflected this position openly in court, that they continue to believe that law, no matter what the state Supreme Court has said, that law is unconstitutional. Those claims are prescribed, or those claims have been filed too late, and so they are basically worthless, the bulk of them.
Let me take a break here, Ramon, if I can. When we come back, one question I have is, I'm looking at your story here. A vast majority of the money in the abuse claimants' proposal, roughly $800 million, should come from the insurance companies, according to the plan. But the church counteroffers with $62.5 million, more than $900 million less than what they were looking for, that $800 million from insurance companies, and then $84 million from the archdiocese and its affiliates. I guess what I'm wondering is, who's negotiating for whom? Is the archdiocese trying to protect their assets or protect the insurance company? Because if I'm the archdiocese, I'm saying, well, if I want to do what's right by everybody, well, then let's turn this over to the insurance company. And why isn't the insurance company involved in this? Maybe you can clear all of that up when we come back. 651 Traffic Now, WWL. 6:56, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back with Ramon Antonio Vargas, editor and reporter at The Guardian. He's got a story about what the church is offering. Victims are seeking $1 billion. Church is offering $62.5 million. I don't know who's lowballing whom here. If we just hear that commercial, is the insurance company lowballing the victims? Is the church lowballing the victims? Why did they not turn this over to the insurance company? I'm confused, Ramon.
Yeah, I've been seeking some clarity in that myself. I mean, I know earlier in the proceeding, right, the insurance companies have certainly spoken up about feeling sort of like not feeling kind of like shut out as far as like the mediation process, as far as like, this process of working towards a settlement, which obviously has been years long and doesn't seem close to happening. While we were on break, right, and one of the attorneys who represents abuse survivors in this case, Bill Arado, right, says, he wonders if insurance companies may argue at some point that they weren't given sufficient notice of the offer that was coming forward. It's obviously it, it, it The church's plan, right, represents a number of kind of like broken promises, even as it stands now, right? Including one being that at one point, you know, the Archdiocese had reflected insurance was going to cover the bulk of it, right? Now they're putting forward a plan that has, you know, that is obviously going to be covered mostly by itself and by its affiliates, right? At one point, very early, the affiliates weren't going to be affected at all. And now, you know, under their plan, you know, they're putting up a chunk of a multi-million-dollar settlement, $62.5 million. I can tell you that on behalf of like the survivors, right? And certainly, I mean, there's way too many of them to name, but certainly you've seen a guy like James Adams on the air. You've certainly seen, you know, his advocates on the air. You know, we've heard the names Richard Strahan, Soren Gisselson, John Danina, all of their clients, Aaron Hebert, you know, all, et cetera. Those do, Christy Schubert, those attorneys, right? I think all of them would find so offensive. Everyone saw that deposition from earlier this year, in which the person that they put in charge of the bankruptcy got a $1 million settlement for a neck injury, yeah. Right? And they're offering their clients, about a tenth of that at this point.
The victims are looking for $2 million in claim. Church is offering $125,000. The victims are saying there's $800 million of insurance money that's available. The insurance companies are certainly going to fight that. You're looking at this either from a Fortune 500 company or from a religion as to limiting liability or doing what's right. And as at this point, we don't know who the lowball offer came from. Was it the insurance company or the archdiocese, or who's representing whom?
I mean, look, the victims are searching for what would be the largest settlement of its kind. That said, I think also the archdiocese's plan also reflects a refusal to accept that the victims now have the constitutional right to seek the claims that they're looking for.
Got to come back. Thank you, Ramon. 6:56, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWO. Quickly back with Ramon Antonio Vargas, editor and reporter at The Guardian. He's got a story about what the church is offering. Victims are seeking $1 billion. Church is offering $62.5 million. I don't know who's lowballing whom here. If we just hear that commercial, is the insurance company lowballing the victims? Is the church lowballing the victims? Why did they not turn this over to the insurance company? I'm confused, Ramon.
Yeah, I've been seeking some clarity in that myself. I mean, I know earlier in the proceeding, right, the insurance companies have certainly spoken up about feeling sort of like not feeling kind of like shut out as far as like the mediation process, as far as like, you know, this process of working towards a settlement, which obviously has been years long and doesn't seem close to happening. While we were on break, right, and one of the attorneys who represents abuse survivors in this case, Bill Arado, right, says, you know, he wonders if insurance companies may argue at some point that they weren't given sufficient notice of the offer that was coming forward. It's obviously the church's plan, right, represents a number of kind of like broken promises, even as it stands now, right? Including one being that at one point, you know, the archdiocese had reflected insurance was going to cover the bulk of it, right? Now they're putting forward a plan that has, you know, that is obviously going to be covered mostly by itself and by its affiliates, right? At one point, very early, the affiliates weren't going to be affected at all. And now, you know, under their plan, you know, they're putting up a chunk of a you know, a multi-million-dollar settlement, $62.5 million. I can tell you that on behalf of like the survivors, right? And certainly, I mean, there's way too many of them to name, but certainly you've seen a guy like James Adams on the air. You've certainly seen, you know, his advocates on the air. You know, we've heard the names Richard Strahan, Soren Gisselson, John Danina, all of their clients, Aaron Hebert, you know, all, et cetera. Those do, Christy Schubert, those attorneys, right? I think all of them would find so offensive. Everyone saw that deposition from earlier this year, in which the person that they put in charge of the bankruptcy got a $1 million settlement for a neck injury, yeah. Right? And they're offering their clients about a tenth of that at this point.
120.
So we'll
looking, the victims are looking for $2 million a claim. Church is offering $125,000. The victims are saying there's $800 million of insurance money that's available. The insurance companies are certainly going to fight that. You're looking at this either from a Fortune 500 company or from a religion as to limiting liability or doing what's right. And as at this point, we don't know who the lowball offer came from. Was it the insurance company or the archdiocese, or who's representing whom?
I mean, look, the victims are searching for what would be the largest settlement of its kind. That said, I think also the archdiocese's plan also reflects a refusal to accept that the victims now have the constitutional right to seek the claims that they're looking for.
Got to come back. Thank you, Ramon.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Knorr sides and bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Knorr taste combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit Knorr.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
I'm John Oran, Puck's sports correspondent, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity, where I will take you inside the executive suites and owner's boxes that run the entire sports business. Twice a week, I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media and give you a window into the inside conversations that are happening throughout sports media. So be sure to follow and listen to The Varsity Podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.